This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 389, and I was talking to the young lady who's living with us now, and I was saying, you know, when we get to 8 years worth of podcasts, you are more than welcome to join us, because we'll do a joint podcast for that. And then I was thinking, when will that be? I mean, I knew it was in March, but I said, okay, so 8 times 52 is 416. I'm at 389 today, which means next week there will be 26 left, which means we're at the midpoint. Well, we're at the midpoint next year. No, next week. Wait. Next week, we are at the midpoint. So there you go. 7.5 years worth of podcasts. All is well at home. Amber has a little dog named Toby. And Toby is gradually getting to know the cats. It's going fine. Just gonna take a little time. But, you know, just every day's a little better. So it's fun. And we had family down over the weekend, and it was really good to see all them again. We hadn't had a chance to talk in a while, so they came in on Friday. They came in Friday. And then they were here Saturday as well. And so Alan, my son-in-law, smoked a bunch of meat. Oh, it was really good. I ate way too much on Saturday. Actually, Friday, too. Got way too much on Saturday. But we took him to see the fantastic caverns. And so they seem to enjoy that. It's a ride-through cave. It's the only ride-through cave in North America. And interesting story. It was discovered by a guy whose dog found a little hole, you know, went in, and then he didn't tell anybody about it because it was during the Civil War, and the Union and the Confederates were in the habit of confiscating caves for the bat guano because they could process the bat guano and turn it into saltpeter for gunpowder. As it turns out, Fantastic Caverns didn't have any bats in it, and so that didn't work out. But the guy actually waited several years until the war was over, and then he put out an ad hoping that some people would volunteer to go down in and explore this cave. And in fact, it was a group of teenage girls from like 13 to 19 that took their candles down there, and they were the first ones in there, at least in modern history. Fun stories. So all is well at work. We're just puttering along. We're getting ready to release a big beta test on a project that we have just been working on for old lands, year and a half now. It was complicated to begin with, but then we've just had, you know, some extra things come along, including new healthcare regulations from the Obamacare stuff, and so it's just been really interesting. It's been one of those projects that you think you're heading in the right direction, and then you realize, no, wait, we need to back up. But I think we made our last changes today and did a little testing on it. Everything seems to be fine, so maybe this next week we're going to release it to beta, maybe the week after. I'd like it for it to be this next week, since got a vacation coming up and would prefer not to release it to beta while I'm on vacation. So we'll see how all that goes. As far as the writing goes, everything's fine. I'm not quite where I'd like to be, but that's okay. I'm close. I have about another 320 pages or so, 330 pages to read on my second read through. And then I should probably do a technical edit. Man, technical edits. If there's one part of writing that is a bit of a burden to me, it's the technical edit. I put my little search criteria in and I look for the word "and." And I go through every "and" in the entire document. I use a lot of "ands." Every word in the entire document. Check to see if the commas are in the right place. Because if you're just saying, "and Bob went here," at the start of a sentence, "and Bob went here," there is no comma. And beyond that, "Bob went there," there is a comma. Just like if we say, "Bob went down the hill and rolled all the way," there is no comma. But if we say, "Bob went down the hill and he rolled all the way," there is a comma. And there is a comma if we say, "not only did Bob roll down the hill, but he did so all the way," there is a comma. I mean, and I still don't have all the commas correct. But at least I make an effort to go through and get all those connectors. I search for "ands" and "buts" and "o" and "ors" and "so" and oi. I don't think I said it for them. Anyway, so it's just a slog. It's hours. Hours and hours of slogging. But that's okay. It's all part of the process. So hopefully I'm going to get all that done this weekend. Start on the cover on Monday night. I think I know all my pieces, so I think I'm going to be able to make this work. Get the cover roughed in this week. Then take pictures of the kids this coming weekend. Not this weekend, but the next weekend. And then get it laid out in InDesign Monday, Tuesday-ish or so, Thursday-ish, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday-ish, and then order the beta copies so they'll be in when I come home. And then start recruiting beta readers. I am to the point now where I've got a pretty steady stock of 20, 25 beta readers. I've got that. And then I just usually go up on Facebook and post, and usually it's not too long before I've got everybody on and ready to go. So anyways, so that all goes well. Today, I realize I've done a couple of topics in a row on women and men and women, but I think we're going to revisit that again today and then next week, which will be the halfway point. I'm going to go ahead and talk about what I've been chatting with my buddies about. One of the things I may need to start doing here at some point is actually keeping a little cheat sheet to remember who I have talked to about what, whom I have talked to about what, because I get an idea and then I start talking with friends about it, and I have enough friends that sometimes I start thinking, "Oh, wait, I talked about that on the podcast." "No, wait, I didn't talk about that on the podcast." So I'm going to pretend like I didn't talk about this on the podcast next week and try to bring together some of the ideas I've been thinking about over the last couple of weeks as I've been reviewing these articles, the book, The Sex Object article, and then the one from last week, which was about how I got sober and discovered the reason that women drink and it infuriated me. Talk about that. And then also wrap up with what we're going to be able talking about today, which is the sexless marriage. This came from a TEDx talk. Okay, and there's going to be some pretty plain language in this. So if plain language offends you, you should shut this off, because the title of this TED talk was Masturbation, Loneliness, Cheating, and Shame. And it was by Maureen McGrath. And I gotta tell you, it was really interesting to me, because when I first watched this TED talk, she seemed a little nervous. She kept rocking back and forth, like either her heels were comfortable or she was nervous talking to a big crowd. She had some interesting things to say, but she never really came to a conclusion. I felt, and she kind of danced around some issues and made some suggestions that I thought, what? And it's really interesting because she quoted some statistics, and I'll be quoting those, and a lot of them don't seem to kind of line up. So if you feel like you're listening to this talk, I was listening to this talk and I was thinking, well, but okay, wait, but if you've got that number and you've got this number, what? So I'll just kind of spray out, what she said, and then kind of give you my reactions to it. This whole thing, which is such a crucial part of our lives, this relationship stuff, this is fascinating to me. And before we get into the article here, one of the things that's so fascinating to me is that we have this idea that we only need to have one yardstick to measure everything by, and in most cases, we/they/it/somebody has decided that the yardstick should be men. So when it comes to testing medicines, in the past, they've tested men. And then they've just decided, and well, women are like men, and they just don't weigh as much and they're shorter. So we'll just take a percentage as to what the dosage should be, and that should be fine, which is a ludicrous idea. Because there are profound and fundamental physiological differences between men and women. Not to mention psychological differences in the way men and women approach life and how drugs might affect that. Thankfully, in recent years here, there's been more and more cross-gender and more cross-racial testing on drugs. But I think one of the huge areas that we really need to grow up in is this idea of what constitutes a quote-unquote normal sex drive and how that should work out, what that should look like. Because the yardstick of what is a person with a healthy quote-unquote sexual attitude has always been men. And in terms of trying to classify women, if they didn't live up to the type of drives that men have, then they were classified as having low sex drive or low libido. What's interesting is that if you watch some of the surveys, read some of the surveys are somewhere in the region of 45 to 50% of women fall into this I think, unfair classification of low libido or low sex drive. And everybody says, oh, that must be a problem. When, in fact, that might be normal. And, in fact, the ones who don't claim to have a low libido may simply be doing that because they're afraid to admit that they have a low libido. So, bearing all that kind of in mind, let me just start spewing out what this... Because she is a family counselor, family practice counselor, and, of course, she sees... And she may even be a specialist when it comes to sexual problems and that kind of thing in marriage. I didn't know for sure. I should have looked that up. Let us assume that she is a specialist. The question that I always want to ask these specialists is, are you having sex a lot? Because I was watching one TikTok where this woman was talking about the sexless marriage, and she says, you know, I'm a sex therapist, which basically means all I do is talk about sex and I never have sex. And immediately when someone says that, I think, wait a minute, then why are we listening to you? Ta-da. But anyway, so lots of statistics, lots of suggestion, lots of sort of just rambling thoughts in this TED Talk. She started off with a joke. If you never have want to, she says, there is an old joke, if you never want to have sex again, get married. Now, what's interesting about that is that everybody laughed. Here's the thing about humor. Humor is based on common experience. So that in itself, that everyone is laughing, that there has been this overarching idea in our society that if you get married, something is going to happen and you are going to end up not having very much sex. There's a reason for that. So we'll get back to that. Anyways, she said many couples, you know, don't have any sex for months. And she says, you know, that's okay if both partners are okay with it. I would submit that it's highly unlikely that both partners are okay with that. But let's go on. She said the problem is when one person does and the other person doesn't. Okay. And that would be most marriages. Okay. She said, you know, in a survey done with 10,000 respondents, and she highlighted that this was mostly men, she said 75% said they were satisfied with their relationships, although 50% were dissatisfied with their sex lives. Those are people who are willing to answer the question, honestly. She says, according to her, we're having sex, but at the wrong time with the wrong people. And by that, she means that we're having sex before we get married. She says typically 10 years before we get married. She said, so we are in essence in a long-term relationship and potentially sexually bored before we mess up the marital bed. So that's what she considers to be one of the problems. Maybe we'll come back to that. She said most brides do not have sex on their wedding nights, and she said 50% of men, see, just keep all these statistics in your head, 50% of men would not have gotten married if they had known their marriage would be sexless. Now, that's the way she said it. She didn't say, for those who are in sexless marriages, 50% say they would not have gotten married if they had known it would be sexless. What she said was 50% of men would not have gotten married if they had known it would be sexless. Okay, so just keep all these statistics in mind. So she said, you know, people are always asking me, how much sex are married people having? And she says, well, not much. She said 7% of married couples set the sheets ablaze. She said most couples are having sex once a week for the first 10 years, and it decreases after that. And then she threw out this 20% of marriages meet the criteria of a sexless marriage that is defined by the experts as less than 10 times a year. You know, with all those other statistics she just quoted, seems like 20% is a little low, especially with the joke at the front. Okay, so anyway, she says, well, why aren't we having sex? So then she talked about a hormone, PEA, that's responsible for that feeling of euphoria, and that declines after first 2 years. And she says, well, communication is key. She said, you know, another reason sex education is the sex education we provide. We teach women that sex is bad. You might get pregnant. We never talk about pleasure. There's positive information. She said, you know, people go from holy matrimony to holy hell. And she just, et cetera, et cetera. You know, she had a lot of things that she thought might be contributing, okay? So she said, she quoted this statistic, which is interesting. She said 10% of people surveyed said that they have checked smartphones during sex. 35% checked them immediately afterwards. And so she thinks that the social media stuff has a lot to do with it, that it's distracting us. She then said that, okay, and this is a little plain warning. She did said that the favorite position, surveys say, is doggy style, and she said, it's not what you're thinking. He's down on all four and begging, and she's playing dead. Big round of laughter with that as well. Again, common experience is the source of humor. Okay, she says, you know, so in her practice, she always asks people, I'm backing into my garage. She always asks people the same questions when they come and they're having problems in their marriage. The first question she asks them is, are you having sex? And she says, I can never get a straight answer out of women. She said, they'll say, well, sometimes, sort of, not sure. She said, I have some that say, well, I'm married. And she says, I reply to them, well, that means no to me. And they often say, yes, you're right, it is no. So, and she said that most complain that their wives never initiate sex. Now then, this was a very good point, very, very good point that she made. She said, women falsely believe that interest and desire precede sex. Why do they believe that? Because that's the way it is for men. But she said, in fact, with a woman, the feeling comes after arousal. So for women, they have to move into the process not really feeling it. You know, not the majority of women. Okay, there are some, and I have known some women in my life. We had a couple at our church, and we used to talk about everything. You know, I and my wife, Nat, and they just talking, you know, there are some who do. But if this is true, that for a majority of women, there's not really this push towards physical intimacy until everything is flowing, then all that decision to actually follow through with intimacy is just based on decision. And that makes it a completely different experience for women than it is for men. You know, she said, and so we have men and they're thinking about, you know, sex all day with their wives, and maybe they've even talked about it ahead of time. That's, well, we're going to go it Thursday night. Okay. So, you know, so the husband comes home and, you know, the woman has been on Facebook and she's feeling hormonal and she's feeling fat and the kids have been screaming all day and she's just, you know. And she is, in this scenario, then required to make a decision when, frankly, she knows there's going to be some drawbacks, all that. She's going to feel insecure. But if she goes have some ice cream, that's better. because she really does want some ice cream. Because carbs will do that to you. They will create a craving, a real craving. So anyways, lots of interesting stuff. So she said she brought a friend home to her house after some function they were at together. And her friend looked up and said, "Oh, Donnie is waiting up." She said, "Why don't you just drive around the block a couple of times until he goes to sleep?" And she said, "I told her," and oh, when she said this, I just looked at the screen. She said, "I told her, you get up there and make love to your husband, because if you don't, someone else will." Oh, so now the best motivation that we can come up with is try to strike fear in a woman's heart, or guilt, or obligation, hoping that once everything starts percolating, then she'll really feel like it. Because then after it, that's not going to help the next time around. I cannot imagine what it would be like to have to keep making a decision to do something simply because you believed if you did not do it, you were going to be betrayed and abandoned. Okay, that's a bad motivation. Anyways, okay. She actually said in this talk, the one thing that makes a woman want to have more sex is if she feels another woman wants her man. Oh, please. You know, so she's got a friend in the car and she's trying to extol all the benefits and how it's good for your complexion and it feels good and blah, blah, blah. And she said her friend just said, keep driving. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, she also said that nothing revs up desire also like trying to have a baby. She said, but having the baby will kill it. Will kill that along with any eroticism. And then she goes through, you know, some other common problems like sexual abuse growing up, like any kind of erectile dysfunction, like the fact that somebody may be gay. She told one story about this guy who was gay, didn't want to tell his parents, and so he was going to marry this woman. And his plan was he was going to wait for his parents to die, and then he was going to divorce her and go marry who he wanted to. Okay. So, according to this woman, sex is the barometer of a marriage. Sexless marriages report frustrated, people in sexless marriages report being frustrated, unloved, feeling frustrated, unloved, undesirable, unattractive, and lonely. And, of course, loneliness has its own things, you know. Anyways, she also claims that, a sexless marriage is the perfect environment to turn on a certain gene. And when that gene gets turned on, people tend to wander, which, okay, that's interesting. She also said that historically marriage is based on acquiring in-laws property and physical labor. That was like up until the beginning of the 1900s, that's what marriage was for. You know, you formed alliances, you got property, you made kids, put them out in the field. This whole romance thing where everything was touchy-feely was not really a part of marriage in the early days. And she says, you know, at the turn of the 20th century was when we burdened marriage with romance. And that is about the time that we have movies. And I would submit as well things like newspapers. We had newspapers before that, but things like newspaper. And that's a whole other thing that I want to leave to next week, because I want to talk about that creation of the standards. What is a man? What is a woman? And how that impacts the sexes. I want to talk about advertising and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so she goes all through all this stuff. She says in ancient aristocracy, courtesans, men had courtesans for pleasure and concubines for quick sex. Now, see, this is very interesting because on one hand, she's saying, well, you know, some of the problems that we're having in marriage just came because of the movies. But in fact, here we go in ancient aristocracies and we've got men visiting women. Why? because their wives aren't that interested in sex. This has been going on for thousands of years, and we really need to recognize the reasons why. So she says, you know, how do you rev up your marriage? Well, you have to work every day at it. You got to get rid of sexual dysfunction, pay more attention to your spouse than the smartphone. She says, fantasy is the key. She said, because you can have sex with whoever you want to as long as it's only in your mind. Okay, that's a bad idea. That's a very bad idea. And then she says, you know, I want to leave you with a bang, so settle all arguments in the bedroom naked. Okay, yeah, great. So, you know, the problem here is the fact that men and women do approach sex very, very differently. Physical intimacy, we'll say. The mating rituals, very, very differently. And I was trying to remember whether I've said this on the podcast or not. The last three, four, 5 weeks, I've been spinning on an idea and exploring ramifications on it. And the idea is very simply this. For men, there is a very distinct and specific process when we talk about sexual function. When that event happens, and every guy I've talked to about goes, yep. You know, we may be all hot and bothered a second before that event happens, but when that event happens, it falls off fast. It's just like kaboom. One of my buddies actually even said, yeah, he said, like, you know, I'll get done, and I'm thinking, what was that all about? Gonna go out root in the kitchen now, looking for something to eat, you know. And this is our lives as men. You know, there's a lot of attraction stuff going on all the time. When we see a pretty girl, there's definitely, hey, there's a pretty girl over there. You know, it's a girl. That is just very, very natural for us. But as soon as the event happens, we're like in our right minds, you know, for at least a little while before it starts building back up again. Mind you, I'm firmly convinced that all of this had to be the way it is for the propagation of the species. So I think there's really good reasons why it's like this. But I think what that teaches men is that drive, that need, that base function in us exists in the real world. It does not exist in our thinking about it. It exists in the real world, and it is cyclical. And it allows us to get some separation from that thing which haunts us. And we realize it is a separate thing. It's like a subsystem out there. Because we feel it flexing, and it's all tied to a specific act. And once that thing, then it's gone. And so it's like, yeah, okay, subsystem, I know how to take care of that, done. Now, whether we take care of that with our wives or whether we don't take care of it with our wives, we get the same response. And we are designed to be attracted to things and to feel that urge before anything else happens. Now, if it's true, and you back up, that women are not designed that way, that they don't actually start feeling that sexual urges until they begin to become aroused, if that's true, and it's also true that in the challenges women face in life, namely their fear, they have no immediate relief, and the relief they find can work just as well, whether it's just something they're thinking about or something they are actually doing, they have a whole host of other mechanisms that they can bring into play that basically have the same effect. So first of all, they have much more variety on how they can choose to deal with the turmoil that's within them. So, ice cream works, chips works, chocolate works, coffee mocha works, watching TV works, petting the cats works, playing with the grandkids works, You know, there's tons of things. Work works. There's tons of things, tons of options. But none of those options have an immediate drop. It's simply a little withdrawal, but the noise is all still there. Which means it very much feels like a foundational, systemic, integral part of life. And it doesn't really feel like something that necessarily is caused by flesh. And I'm going to stop there, and then next week we're going to talk some more and try to kind of pull together these last 3 weeks, because I don't have any notes on this, and if I just try to do it off the cuff, I'm not going to say it right. Next week is actually going to be a talk that I do from notes that I wrote for this is what I think is going on at this point in my life. And then when we get another 10 years down the road, we'll see whether it is or not. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.